This webcast is made possible in part by support from the listener members of the Classical Network, WWFM and WWFM.org. Thank you for your support. Cadenza, winner of the Deems Taylor Virgil Thompson Award for Broadcasting, is a production of the Classical Network. Funding for this program is made possible by the listener members of the Classical Network. I'm David Ozenberg, your host. Over these weeks on this program, we're featuring important American composers, alternating with weeks with great instrumentalists, conductors, and singers. This week is a composer week, and we'll chat with a musician who's been called American music's Renaissance man, composer, conductor, multi-instrumentalist, and author David Amram. Now in his 87th year, he is releasing his fourth book called The Next 80 Years, and you could not pack more into his first four score. Born just north of Philadelphia on a farm, surrounded by music growing up, he started as a French horn player in the National Symphony Orchestra, but was also performing jazz and became the first noted improvising jazz French horn player. He would move in artistic circles that had him working with a list of artists that included the likes of Dizzy Gillespie, Lionel Hampton, Willie Nelson, Langston Hughes, Charles Mingus, LaVon Helm, Betty Carter, and the poet Jack Kerouac, with whom in 1957, my guest started the jazz poetry readings in New York City and the Beat Movement was born. Great musicians like Charlie Parker and Thelonious Monk were mentors, and he also worked with Dimitri Mitropoulos, Aaron Copland, Gunther Schuller, and more than a few eyebrows were raised when Leonard Bernstein named him the first composer in residence for the New York Philharmonic back in 1966. He already had some noted film scores under his belt, such as The Manchurian Candidate and Splendor in the Grass. My guest has composed more than 100 orchestral and chamber works. A new CD has just been released on the Effetto label, chronicling his chamber music spanning these many decades. You're listening to the third movement of his Three Lost Loves, this movement titled Sal and Terry, the Mexican Girl, based on Jack Kerouac's On the Road for violin, alto, saxophone, and piano, performed by one of my guest's great champions, violinist Elmira Darvarova, with Kenneth Rednofsky on sax and Thomas Weaver on piano. It's a world premiere recording of this 2016 work. My guest's American roots are widely evident in his music, as is the cultures of many different countries and societies around the globe, as he has traveled to more than 80 different countries as a music ambassador and was in the first group of artists to travel to Cuba after the Castro regime took hold back in the 1970s. In a word, he has accomplished and done a lot. This will be the first of two programs featuring this chat with my guest, which took place in New York City a few months back. Thank you.
Today, with I don't even know how to list everything you are, but we'll start with composer and kinds of other things. David Amram, congratulations on the CD. I know it's just another big kind of boulder on this incredible mountain of a career you have, but what's nice is the So in America CD highlights chamber compositions and so much of what's available on CD. I mean, I've played it on the air, some of your orchestral things that you did with Larry Craman and Newport and all that kind of stuff. So it's nice to have some of this chamber stuff out there. In a 13-year span of the Cadenza programs, over 600 programs, I don't know if I've had a guest who's worked with or known such a cross-section of great artists as you. What's nice about the disc is if you step back, it kind of gives you a nice snapshot of your career, the earliest works from 1958. But before we go into these and sort of trace your career with the pieces on the disc, I wanted to back up further, if we could, and kind of set the table for many of your accomplishments and groundbreaking society, cultural, changing ideas. You grew up just north of Philly. Family then moved to D.C. Growing up, your house was kind of abuzz with music. It was Jewish music, classical, jazz. So how did that lay the groundwork for you?
Well, my family were music lovers, in the best sense of the word. And my father loved Brahms, and he used to try to play the piano reduction of the Brahms First Symphony. But since we lived on a farm, and he'd been a farmer early in his life, he had those big fingers and those big hands, really strong. But he never practiced the Czerny technique too much, so he would just play the beginning of the Brahms, bling, bling, blang, then hit a humongous clinker, curse, and go back to the note or the measure before. So it would take him about an hour and a half to get through the first movement. But like a mountain climber who slips and slides and then goes up a little bit, he managed to get to the top or finish it. And I learned a lesson that you can also do that as a composer, a player, and a person. And if you have a direction, I wouldn't even say a goal, but a direction, and you keep plugging away, eventually you can get there. Yeah. And if you can't do it brilliantly the first time, you can just keep on trying. And when I wrote my piano concerto a few years ago, I thought, well, turned 80, I said, I can really not worry what anybody thinks about something being too enjoyable or too... I thought, I'm just going to write the most beautiful thing I can think of. So I was working away. And my friend Audrey was with me, and when we premiered the piece in San Jose, California, the manager of the orchestra said, David, he said, that's the most beautiful thing I've ever heard that you wrote. And he said, Audrey, I know you were with them. What was it like being there, hearing this beautiful... She said, all I remember the whole summer was, ah, 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 blang, 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 curse, curse, rip up the papers, ah. But I did manage to get the right notes. It just took me, just as my father, hearing him play the piano, just slaving away the way a woodcarver chips away, or a sculptor chips away, or when you're doing the 14 coats of polyurethane on the floor and you're supposed to sand each one by the 11th, you say, ah, I guess it doesn't matter, no one will know the difference. But it does make a difference. Yeah. And when I hear Elmira play and her husband, Howard Wall, the great French horn player, play, they make it sound and feel so easy and effortless. You can just sit back and say, isn't that a miracle? And then people don't realize how many years of their life they spent just working away, practicing and listening and thinking about it. And when you see the Olympics and you see those phenomenal athletes doing this incredible stuff, leaping around and making it look easy, that's the idea, to make the person who's perceiving it feel something and enjoy it and make it look like it's effortless, almost like a miracle. Right. And a lot of that great achievement or results comes from that hard, hard work. Not I learned from my father as a little boy, listening to him practice.
Hanging out the Bronx.
And then meeting other musicians and seeing, you know, they would say, you know, try it again, and after the 400th time, you finally see what it is you're supposed to do. And as a composer, I always say the two greatest technological inventions of the 20th century were the eraser and the wastebasket. And then if you improvise all the time the way I do, you can feel what seems to be natural at the moment, and then use that sensibility when you get a second, third, and 28th chance to try to get the notes to be right.
Here is the second movement, titled Blues, from my guest David Amram's work Travels for Trumpet and Orchestra. The soloist is Chris Gecker, and the Manhattan Chamber Orchestra is conducted by Richard Alden Clark.
you're playing French horn, you go to Oberlin. I mean, you could have gone the path of being an orchestral horn player, a gigger, a straight gigger. I guess we're in the late 40s, early 50s now, you've got your service in there. But, you know, all of a sudden you're hanging out with, you know, name them, Charlie Parker, Dizzy Gillespie, these type of people, a little bit later, Jack Kerouac. And, you know, you start to carve out these other paths than just going to a straight horn player.
Well, I say it wasn't, you were very gracious to mention the career. I was kind of brought up to realize that rather than pursuing a career, building a career, you should build a life.
Okay.
So every day is a new experience, and I try each day to do whatever I can that touches my heart. When I met Elmira, I was guest conducting the Grand Park Symphony. They had this fantastic woman concertmaster who I didn't know was the first woman concertmaster of the Met. I just remember how terrific she was. This was in the 1980s, or 1990s, early 1990s. And then there was a New York Chamber Music Festival. I said, boy, I'd love to get something in that. So I wrote this person I didn't know a letter. She said, you don't remember me. I remember you. I remember your music. And I was thinking of doing something of yours. So I just stumbled and fumbled, as I have continued to do all my life. And then her husband, Howard Waltz, is a great French horn player. He'd been in the Philadelphia Orchestra. They played a piece of mine, but I never had the pleasure of meeting him. And then because of our all mutual interest in music, without any idea, we kind of started collaborating on things, and I ended up writing a piece, and now I'm doing a concert. Almira's going to play the Elegy for Violin and Orchestra. No career counselor ever would have endorsed anything that I did. So when I met Jack Kerouac at a Bring Your Own Bottle party, and he didn't even have a book published, I never thought meeting somebody in a lumberjack at a Bring Your Own Bottle party would end up collaborating with this author for 12 years. And almost everybody I continue to meet every day becomes part of my life, and I hope to become part of theirs. I don't say that because I'm a stumble bum, but you can stumble or be fortunate enough to be aware of everybody that crosses your path, and there's some terrific people that you can learn from every day. And if you're very exclusive to say, well, that person can't help me to move up another echelon, then that's one way to go, I guess. But then you miss out on some of the most beautiful things.
The oldest piece on the disc is 1958.
Right.
And all I was doing is leading up to that. But even by that point, you had established not only connections and performed with, but you were going in a lot of different directions in your career, and had, what I'm getting at is the confidence you must have had to say, yeah, this is okay, you know?
Well, I just did what I loved, that I felt natural, and I learned the most important things for the tuition, which is to say, please, thank you. That was beautiful. Can you show me one more time? Please. And then remember to always say that. And then if you're in a different country, a different culture, can you say, could you please show me the one? So if you got a rhythm, you say, I think I've got it, but where's the one? Where was the... And sometimes the one is a whole different place than we would think there's a one. When I learned Pescao, when I was in Panama, it's called a tamborita. I didn't know anything about that. And I heard this melody that went, goong, 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 goong. And that sounded to me like, you're left, you're left, you're left.
Right.
And actually it was, you're left, you're one. You're and I couldn't figure that out. And the conductor of the Panama Symphony, where I was guest conductor, said, David, you have to feel that in your blood. And he got up and started dancing around the room, singing the bass drum part, and then bringing in the one which came after that. And it was so terrific. And he showed me all four parts. But that's not only because I could speak Spanish. I could also say, por favor, señor, dando es uno, por favor, sir, where's the one, please? And he showed me the structure of it. And you can continue your whole life to learn about that. And then when you think you know something, then you go back, and the people who were born into that culture can show you all the little refinements of the sound. So it's a constant thing of learning, and it's very exciting.
And that where's the one can be translated in
so
many different languages.
So it's get to be 87 like it. Instead of being a nasty, enraged, embittered old wretch, you could be an old wretch, but you could be a studious, enthusiastic, and grateful old wretch. That's kind of what I'm aiming towards.
So back to the new recording of Chamber Works by my guest David Amram on the Effetto label. Here's a work for viola and piano with Ronald Carbone, violist, and Thomas Weaver on the piano, the work titled The Wind and the Rain from 1958.
Thank you.
1958 piece is The Wind and the Rain, viola and piano. This theme came from the work you were doing with Joseph Papp.
Yes.
And the Shakespeare Festival.
Right.
So in that time, your music was getting a wide exposure there through your film work, the scores, Mentoring Candidate, Splendor in the Grass. Those mediums are reaching people who may not attend a jazz concert, may not go to a classical concert, they're hearing your music, a different way to get your music out. I'm just curious because that doesn't continue. I mean, your career is so multifaceted, but those were important things, right? For people to hear your music.
They became that way recently. Yeah. Because now that they show The Manchurian Candidate after it was buried for 40 years, and they show Splendor in the Grass after it was considered to be kind of corny, and some people knew that I was a composer, they thought, but had no idea that I'd ever done those films.
Right.
Because when I did them, no one basically had ever heard me. The ones that did hear me would see me playing jazz. They didn't know I was constantly at home composing. Composing is the gyroscope of my life, and always has been. And everything else that I've done and lived goes into that. So now when people hear The Manchurian Candidate, they say, gee, that was nice music. I said, well, that's because I had the dream, and still do, someday some of my music might have what Leonard Bernstein told me it should be when he chose me as the first composer in residence of the Philharmonic, 1966-67. He said, David, your job in music is not only to please yourself, you're supposed to contribute something to the repertoire. In other words, we were all here for a while, and if we were fortunate, we could put something in that great big treasure chest of music and add our little bit. So it wasn't about how to be Superman and demolish the opposition and change the history of the earth. It was just to put something beautiful in with all of those other treasures that are already there. And when Bernstein said that in 1966, that's when you're supposed to set the piano on fire and throw it out the window so you could get a bigger write-up of the Times because you didn't like American foreign policy. All that stuff's great too, but that has nothing to do with music, with composition, or with anything to add to the beauty that's already there. And Dizzy Gillespie told me on his 70th birthday, he said, I met you, you were a 19-year-old hick in your basement apartment. Now you have gray hair. It's time to put something back into the pot. And he told me the New Orleans idea of the gumbo, where everyone puts a little nutritious element into that stew, which then re-nourishes you and your family when you partake of that.
So many sides of what you compose. I hear in the next piece, we move up to 1960 with the violin sonata that Elmira plays so beautifully. But even then, I mean, the first movement, maybe I'm wrong on this, first movement I hear you kind of with your classical composer hat on. You know, you got the form going, all the rest of this stuff. Second movement is this Jewish prayer. Again, back to your roots. And I think you said something, especially when you started to delve into other cultures, that you had to be comfortable with yourself before you can go find somebody else's culture
Otherwise, people think you're going to them because you despise yourself and you want to rip off something of theirs to become them. And the basic thing is, if you don't, as they say in the vernacular, if you don't dig yourself, you can't possibly dig what I have. And if they see that you would appreciate what you were born with, regardless of what you move to. If you don't have that, then you can't have a deeper spiritual understanding of other people's lives and what they went through to maintain their beautiful traditions. One of the things I'm most proud of is that Elmira, who's a monster great international classical artist, wrote a little piece using some of her folkloric traditions of Bulgarian music, combining that with that magnificent conservatory-trained virtuoso stuff, and creating a beautiful piece. And I heard that, I said, boy, I wish I'd written that. But I couldn't, because I don't know, first of all, the folklore, and I was listening to it. It was so beautiful. And it made me feel good to know that maybe somebody, because of appreciating what I was fumbling and stumbling into, decided they could dare to express themselves and tell their story. That's a very beautiful thing. And I was encouraged by musicians of every genre to try to be yourself and do what you have to offer rather than everything except what you were brought up to think. Right. It was too bad that you were. And that we all have to overcome that in America. And that's beginning to happen with programs like yours that can be heard on the internet and streamed. And things of beauty on the internet and YouTube. There are options So when all of us who are incarcerated in what I call the penitentiary of bad taste can now move from the jail cell we're assigned to and go beyond that and go beyond the stereotype or branding of who we're told we are or you are. And it's a wonderful, wonderful thing to see that's happening.
Stick with the violence on the third movement, Theme and Variations, which is a theme that Jack Kerouac said, hey, you should do something with that. What I'm saying is this sonata, which kind of casts you in a very classical type of framework, three movement, violin sonata, blah, 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 boom, is still very much you. I was kind of dovetailing that into the Bernstein appointment with New York Phil. That was a bold move by Bernstein.
He
didn't pick an academic writing, strict dogmas, you know.
That's putting it mildly.
Yeah, I know. What was the backlash? Was there backlash to you at that time saying, what are you doing as composer?
Well,
composer residence was a new thing anyway.
I was the very first one. And I think they sent a letter saying that 300 people could apply. And I had just gotten the package back. I never got anything. And it was, as usual, the package was returned without anybody even looking, bothering to open up the music, which is okay. They're all very busy. So I thought, well, I have the package. And then I got a call. We used to have answering services saying I've been chosen. So I thought maybe it was a joke. And I called, and sure enough, they were serious. And I was about to get a job as a bartender in the Village because I was offered an appointment as being a composer to replace this terrific, wonderful, classically oriented composer at a great music school for a year. And I thought, wow, wouldn't that be exciting? But then they told me at the institution I could not mention the word jazz. I couldn't talk about improvising. I couldn't talk about Latin music or Native American music or all the different beautiful musics I'd been exposed to. I just had to eliminate all that. And I couldn't play any place because then I would be defaming their department. And I said, you know, that's like asking me to amputate a leg. I couldn't do that. That's part of whatever I do comes from that. And so my neighbor said, look, you could be a bartender. You know everybody in the Village. You could work 2 days a week. You pay hardly any rent. You're single. So I was about to go with my old friend and learned to be a bartender, and then I got this phone call saying I'd been chosen with the Philharmonic. And I honestly believe, without being unduly modest, if my name was Zabruski, I never would have gotten it because Lenny was so busy, I doubt that he had time to go over the 300 names. So since I was A, and they had it listed alphabetically, he told me years later he'd heard my music for Shakespeare in the Park wafting over Central Park when he lived close to there at one of his places, and he liked the score I had done for Venturing Candidate and Splutter in the Grass, which I was proud of, because I wrote them and orchestrated them myself with the dream that someday, if I were a composer that anybody was interested in, and they played those films, I wouldn't have to apologize, or I wouldn't have to say that was my ghostwriter's fault, because I didn't use a ghostwriter, and I didn't use an orchestrator, which I was told I should do. I did it myself. Scarcely an original move, as most composers in history did write their own music. So when those became better known, I always said, I'm not a film composer. I'm a composer who occasionally writes for films. I put as much loving effort into those as I did when I was trying to write my symphonic and chamber and operatic works.
So from my guest's 1960 Sonata for Violin and Piano, here's the third movement, A Theme and Variations. The violinist is Elmira Darvarova with pianist Thomas Weaver. This again from the new CD on the Effetto label called So in America, Selected Chamber Music Compositions, 1958 to 2017. Music by my guest today, David Amram. Thank you.
the next piece on the disc moves up 10 years to 1970. It's dedicated, I want to get her name right, dedicated to Jean Dale Katz.
Yeah.
And I think this is an area, I mean, there's so much that you've done in your career and there's so many things that sometimes this part of your career might get kind of lost in the fog because she dedicated her life to making sure young people got to hear music.
Oh, did she ever.
And you've done all that work. You did all the work with the Brooklyn Phil and all that stuff, and I know it's important to you. I just, you know, just sort of put it out on the record that this has always been part of your career to make sure that new ears, especially young ears...
Well, that's not a career move. In fact, when I looked like I was enthusiastic at the Brooklyn Academy, after a few years, they figured the guy's any good, he wouldn't want to be here. And they were shocked that I loved it and had a good time.
Yeah.
But the musicians weren't shocked. They were just glad they could come someplace on a trust fund gig, which pays hardly anything. And each time we could all get together, like it was our first and last concert at Carnegie Hall, and try to have it be what it always is, a beautiful experience, where when you see the kids, see the musicians having a good time and really playing up a storm, because everybody wants to play music, that learns music, and not having a conductor that was saying, "Ach tu, you Schwein, my career's in tatters, I shouldn't be here with these creeps, I should be at Buckingham Palace." That doesn't help out. So if you can just have it where it's musical and the music takes us all over, then it's always a terrific experience. So for me, it was a thrill to go out there and see these people go all the way out to the Brooklyn Academy on the subway, play up a storm, and then jump on the subway and go back to a better gig.
Yeah.
But play just as beautifully every single time. It was just a miracle. And when they couldn't make it, they send in a sub, and they were fantastic. So being around all that expertise for the 29 years, I even learned a lot about rudiments of conducting, including staying out of the way when it's happening and not wrecking it. And I had a good enough relationship with the musicians, so they said, "Look, speaking of where is the one," they might say, "This is great, but we can't quite see where the one is." Then I say, "Uh-oh, I better stop trying to be expressive and just lay out something."
Yeah.
And in fact, the orchestra that Elmira was the concertmaster of, 2 years before she came, we were doing the Rakowski March, and I said to the orchestra, "This is a French composer writing a Hungarian march in kind of a Russian style, and it should be this and that." And I was going to this big metaphysical thing. "Mr. Sokolov, great, great viola player," said David. He said, "You've been here several years. You're a talented guy. We like you." He said, "But really, just tell us slower or faster, louder or softer, and we'll do the rest." And everybody cracked up. And of course, it was true. And you learn those things from other people who know more. And if somebody's been playing a cello all their life, chances are, as a composer or a conductor, if they suggest something, they know what they're talking about because they've been doing it for 30 or 40 years.
Right. There is a process mundane side to making music, which just has to be.
And that's true in everything, in folk music and jazz and Latin music. I was just in Cuba for the first time in 41 years. That was incredible. And the last movement of the new concerto I'm writing is dedicated in memory of Mario Bauza's dear friend Machito, and Celia Cruz, the great singer. And I was trying to figure out something called the wawanko, how to do that and not have it sound cheap or trashy or like a bad Carmen Miranda with a basket of fruit over her head, a Hollywood version of a great old culture. And when I was there playing and listening and being with the musicians, I suddenly got an epiphany and realized, well, they're using their roots, but they're being very creative above and beyond those. And it kind of freed up my mind to dare to do what I wouldn't have done otherwise. So you could always be learning every minute wherever you are.
You say nonchalantly, "I haven't been there 40 weeks," but the fact is, the first time you was there was the first time any Western musicians were allowed to go there after Castro, you and Gillespie and all the rest.
And that was, again, just a stumble of fate, because a friend of Elmira's, a great cellist, was married to the person who had a cruise line, and she went did a concert in Cuba. And she said to him, "Look, you should have this jazz cruise that has no customers and try to see if you can make a cruise to Cuba." So sure enough, they had Dizzy Gillespie staying at Earl Hines and Lionel Hampton. And Lionel Hampton got a better gig and decided not to go, and they were stuck for 48 hours before. They said, "Who could we get?" And someone who worked in the office said, "You could get Amram. He can speak Spanish, he can play with anybody, and he's not expensive." I didn't put the "not expensive" part of my brochure. It was just a fluke that I was able to go there. It was an extraordinary experience.
Yeah, I mean, of everything done, that had to be one of the highlights.
And I learned so much that it was a big chapter, like so many other things in my life. And I say that because anybody, any parents or teachers or young people themselves who are listening and are told by their career counselors, you're 23 years old, you're washed up, it's too late, or you have to be in a certain place and associate with certain people and do certain things in order to achieve some kind of a goal. That may be true to an extent, but the real education and truthfulness and joy and development and lifetime of learning and loving and sharing and having some reason for being in music just comes from having an open mind and an open heart. Yeah. And that's what Wagner, of all people, said. He said, to appreciate my music, all you need is an open mind and an open heart. I loved that so much, I didn't care what his politics
who
were.
Who it came from.
Because musically, he was on the case.
Yeah.
Especially his orchestral music. As George Bernard Shaw said, some of the most magnificent music ever written, interrupted by singing.
You can go to the Mark Twain quotes, too, for some fun.
Composer David Amram. My chat with David will conclude on next week's program, and you can find out more about him at his website, davidamram.com. The new recording from which we've been sampling, So in America, Selected Chamber Music Compositions 1958 to 2017, is on the Effetto label, founded and run by our good friend, recording engineer John Baker. Check out that recording and all the Effetto releases at Effetto, A-F-F-E-T-T-O, recordings.com. The Effetto label is also distributed by Naxos, so you can find this release at naxos.com. And as a special program note, this Monday evening on Celebrating Our Musical Future, we'll have a concert from the Interschool Orchestras of New York, a gala concert in tribute to my guest, David Amram and Leonard Bernstein. In addition to music of Bernstein's Candide and the symphonic dances from West Side Story, will be music of my guest, and special guest soloist will be the violinist we've heard from this new from the new recording we've been sampling, Elmira Darvarova. It's Monday evening at 8 on Celebrating Our Musical Future. I'll leave you with the final minutes of the work dedicated to the memory of Jean Dale Katz, whose devotion to bringing classical music into the lives of children made it possible for thousands of young people to discover the treasures of this music at the summer camps she and her husband created. The work is titled Elegy for Violin and Piano. Once again, violinist Elmira Darvarova performs with pianist Thomas Weaver. Music of my guest today, David Amram. Remember, the conclusion of our chat will be on next week's program. And as always, I'm glad you were in the audience today. And I hope you'll join me here each week for a chat with the great classical musicians of our area and the globe. Remember, you can catch any recent past Cadenza program by going to wwfm.org and clicking on Classical and then Webcasts. I ask you to please support this and the many specialty programs we offer by making your donation today at our website. Thank you, and thanks for listening. I'm David Ozenberg, and this has been the award-winning Cadenza, an exclusive production of the Classical Network and WWFM.org. Thank you.
Thank you.